Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pace. Tonight, we discuss how the internet has provided a platform for cyber harassment. Social media platforms such as Facebook, Twitter, and Reddit have heralded a shift in the way opinions are expressed and in who is allowed to express them. But the so-called democratizing power of the online commentary world has its dark side. Methods of cyberbullying such as trolling or doxing have become tactics to shame, intimidate, and silence opposing voices. Disproportionately targeting women, people of color, and the LGBT communities, sites have also paved the way for individuals to spread hate and violence. At the end of last year, a survey released by Amnesty International claims that 1 in 5 women have experienced abuse online. While trolling is nothing new in online communities, cyber harassment is more pervasive and potentially more destructive. Cyber harassment is not without its consequences. Victims may be silenced, forced to change their line of work, their address, or even their name. And in some cases, the wrong individual may be targeted. Case in point, following the Charlottesville white nationalist rally, a University of Arkansas professor was misidentified as a neo-Nazi and was forced into hiding. In this current environment of cyberbullying, we ask, how do we understand freedom of speech when it comes to doxing and trolling and other forms of cyberbullying? What recourse does a target of doxing and trolling have, and how can you protect yourself from these attacks? Joining me by phone to discuss these issues are two guests. First, Nellie Bowles, a reporter for The New York Times covering Silicon Valley and internet culture. She was formerly a correspondent for Vice News and has written for The Guardian, San Francisco Chronicle, and Recode. Welcome, Nellie.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
And secondly, we are joined by Professor Michelle Ferrier. She's Associate Professor of Journalism at Ohio University Scripps College of Communications and founder and creator of Trollbusters.com, a website supporting women journalists, bloggers, and publishers who are targets of cyber harassment. Welcome, Professor Ferrier.
Thank you for having me on, Joseph.
And, of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. You can tweet us or text us now at the number. The way to do that is you can text us at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisions@klw. You could also call us in about 20 minutes. Our toll-free number is 866-798-TALK. Again, 866-798-8255. So, Professor Ferrier, I wanted to start with you. I threw out a couple of terms there, trolling, doxing. For some of our listeners, these may not be familiar phrases. Could you give us a working definition? I understand there's some controversy in this area of what exactly connotes trolling and doxing, but can you help us understand a basic concept of these two acts, online acts?
Well, basically, doxing is when personal information is leaked online about your home address, your work address, relationships, family members, and other different types of information. And that information may lead people to actually engage in some kind of act in physical space, whether that's swatting, using the police to send police and tactical forces to your home, or to just terrorize you in physical space. And so doxing is the releasing of that personal information. I don't use the word troll because it is a very, very debated kind of word, and I think it's misleading in terms of helping the audience understand the kinds of ways and actors that we now see online perpetrating this kind of violence against women's voices, journalists, people of color online, purposely trying to bring their voices down. So we use the term perpetrator to describe a variety of different kinds of actors online that might be engaging in this activity and really try and stay away from the word troll.
Okay. So tell us, who are the people who are perpetrating these types of activities online?
I think in the terms of the types of things that we see, particularly when working with journalists, it can range from what we kind of describe as the one-off troll, which may be an irate reader. It could be a colleague. It could be an old boyfriend, someone who's coming after you persistently. What we also see is the dynamic of smart mobs or groups of people who are targeting women journalists and journalists of color online, attempting to discredit them, where it seems as if either large operatives or even bots might be used to be able to simulate a feeding frenzy that begins to erode away the identity and the credibility of the journalists themselves.
And when we're talking, so those are some of the tactics people use and who they might be. But are these people who sort of do this casually? Are there people out there for whom this is a regular day-to-day activity?
I think it runs the spectrum, and that's why we don't use that word monolithically like that to describe everyone. I think here in the United States, at least in the past year, I think the general public has become much more aware of the ways in which the internet has been weaponized through our algorithms, through the content that's being shared on a variety of different platforms and feeds, and also through these kinds of very dangerous and criminal activity of people attempting to discredit and silence voices online. So we see a spectrum of activity that all falls under that definition of trolling. Whether it rises to the legal definition of harassment is another issue, but all of that falls under the larger umbrella of online violence that we see online.
So we'll get back to legalities and where norms and ethics help us or don't in understanding or adjudicating these practices in a moment. But I wanted to get another part of this. When it comes to political persuasion, is there a particular lopsidedness in this, or is this kind of all comers?
Joseph, really, bottom line for me, I believe anybody can be a troll on any issue. I think if there's something that triggers you and is hot button enough that you can act in behaviors and ways that can cause emotional damage to someone else online. So I don't think there's any particular political persuasion, etc., that can be a troll. That said, there are organized groups that I have seen use the internet in concerted ways, whether that might be in and around Gamergate issue, whether it's in and around the campaigns of women politicians, etc., that are concertedly trying to bring their voices down. And frankly, again, I don't think there's a particular political persuasion that you would see in that activity.
So Nellie Bowles from the New York Times, tell us your take on the landscape of perpetrators that are trying to defame people online, are trying to threaten them or harass them or intimidate them.
Yeah. Michelle, I loved your sort of pushing back on the word trolling and then also your definition of doxing in general. And thank you for the work that you're doing. The landscape, from my perspective as a female tech reporter, is it really started in 2014 around Gamergate, which was a coordinated sort of internet attack against women in tech and female reporters in particular, sort of posting nasty things on our social media and personal information about different women who dared to be in the tech world, I guess. It has since grown as a movement and as a practice. You've seen it move far beyond the sort of niche video game worlds of 4chan and Reddit where these were being coordinated. And I think it's become much more mainstream. I think that idea that there's one political party behind it is false. I think it's more of a cultural movement. I think anyone can engage in trolling and doxing.
And as I said in my introduction, this isn't a new thing, right? My understanding is that this type of cyber attacks, cyberbullying has been going on for quite some time.
I mean, as long as we've had the internet and the ability to interact with each other,
there was a reason why female journalists didn't use their real names back in the olden days.
What's changing, or what's changed at this time in this historical moment that makes this different, if it is?
There's a lot more awareness of it now. Like, all of a sudden, in the last year or two, there's a lot more awareness. In 2014, when this was happening, the idea was, or when this was starting, the idea was, these are just words that are happening online. Oh, your personal information was posted. Well, you shouldn't have made it so easy to find. And it wasn't really taken so seriously, I found, and most likely because it was largely a women's issue. That has changed. As doxing and these harassment campaigns have gone more mainstream, have become more coordinated, have affected men, it is now taken much more seriously, and now also there's sort of a plan of action. I mean, Michelle, the kind of work you do, like, there are organizations and groups now to support you when you're going through something like this. We understand the process now. And, one interesting case, and this is not really a doxing trolling situation, but Justine Sacco, the IAC PR representative who was fired after tweeting a joke that went really viral in 2012. It was like one of the most viral things. She was, I don't know if you guys followed this whole thing, but anyway, she was just rehired at the company that originally laid her off or fired her. But I think there's sort of a reckoning that's happened this year where people are starting to realize that some of these internet mobs and internet behaviors can be fixed, can be looked at again.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Joseph.
No, it's fine, Michelle.
I was just going to say, I think there's four things, particularly for journalists, that have happened right now that really has created kind of a perfect storm, maybe five things. One is that journalists more and more are being called to use social media and social media type tools to distribute and engage with their audiences online. So the time that they're spending in the online environment versus in front of a computer or typing up something that goes into a print distribution has shifted tremendously. Secondly, that in that work, journalists are asked to bring their authentic selves, so their real identities, that's very much linked to their social identities. And so there isn't the opportunity, especially in this engaged environment, for them to hide behind other resources. We're attempting to be more transparent, more authentic, more connected with our audiences, and that's problematic in the environment when everybody else can be anonymous. The third thing that we're just seeing is the speed at which things happen online is very different than in the olden days when we used to get hate mail that came through the postal system. things can devolve very quickly online to the point where
I would rather get letters.
Much harmed within the space of just several minutes and hours. And then four, the real dangers, as Melanie has talked about this online activity migrating into an offline space, into physical space, is much more likely today because people do have access to a lot of information about our identity from which they can find us and engage with us in physical space.
So that's quite a list of factors that make it seem almost impossible to try to address. I wanted to ask a little bit more, and maybe this is an obvious, the answer to this question is obvious, but why are women journalists and people of color being on the receiving end, being targeted more so? I mean, I want to put that out there because I think it's worth talking about.
Why are women always targeted?
We're the canaries in the coal mine. So we live in systems and a culture which is deeply patriarchal and misogynistic. And when we as women have engaged in these spaces online and the internet and technology, et cetera, and platforms that give us more voice and the ability to be able to spread that voice, there has always been the backlash from systems in order to be able to shut down those voices. And so we're seeing the same types of dynamics play out online here with women's voices. And as I said, systematic efforts to intimidate and remove people from their online presence, which in this day and age is the place where people create their voice and their identity.
Mm. Yeah, they want to make you scared to enter the town square and scared to enter the conversation. Certainly you can live offline, but then you leave the conversation. And that is in many ways the goal of these campaigns. One thing that, Michelle, that you said that I think is really true is we live right now in a very raw, personal way with the internet. Anyone at any point could have access to the front of my phone, basically. If you send me a tweet, it notifies me, and I glance down and look at it all day long. And so with that sort of insane intimacy, these things get scarier and more personal than they've ever been.
And yet,
that goes beyond gender, I think.
And yet, one of you mentioned the anonymity here, right? I think it was you, Michelle Ferrier, was saying how journalists have to put themselves out there, and yet the commentators don't have to divulge their identity, and in fact, in many cases, don't. So, is it that the space being virtual kind of just gives people license that they didn't have in other spaces, some real spaces as opposed to virtual spaces?
There's advantages and disadvantages to the technology. The technology is neutral; it's how it's being wielded. And it can be wielded for good or for evil. For example, Twitter, in response to some of this online abuse, put in place a blocking tool, which you would think would be a good filter for people to be able to filter out those types of voices that they don't want to hear. However, we've seen that tool used in the reverse, where it's actually used where multiple people will report someone who is not necessarily engaging in anything against community rules, and that person will be automatically blocked from the platform until there's some kind of a human review. And so the tools can be used to silence in the same ways that it silenced the individual who doesn't want to hear other people. They can also be silenced using those same tools. So I think when we look at how we need to look at solutions to this, it's not just a platform responsibility. There has to be some individual responsibility as well.
Mm-hmm. And Nellie, when it comes to thinking about the rules of civic discourse, what do we have to lean on to help us kind of get a handle on how society should be addressing these concerns?
I'm not totally sure that I understand your question, but
well, I mean, we have laws around, you know, libel and slandering when it's in print. What do we have to hang on to here, if anything?
God, I don't know the legal technicalities of it all, but not really. I mean, I don't want to say anything one way or another, but it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot to lean on. Often because it's anonymous. But I don't think that just because something's online means it's like radically different. I think we can bring the same sort of morals and ethics we have to the internet, and we should expect people to behave that way. I don't think like trolls are some special, unique creature. Anyway, just adding to what Michelle was saying. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Michelle, you would probably know the laws better than I would.
Apologies. I'm sorry. Nellie, I couldn't hear what she'd asked there.
You would know the laws better than I would on the libel situation here.
Mm-hmm. Well, just in the same way, I think, Joseph, that I described earlier, that to use the word troll to describe all the different kinds of activity that we see online really masks the kind of scope of problem that I think people are beginning to recognize that we have. Secondly, when we look at the types of threats that people are receiving, it's everything from insults on what they're wearing on camera to unfortunate pictures being sent through back channels, to people getting death threats and rape threats in their feeds. And so we're seeing a range of different kinds of threats that require the kinds of responses, and to respond very differently as an individual journalist if I'm getting a death threat in my feed versus if somebody is saying, you really didn't ask appropriate people in this story, and you didn't source the story appropriately. Those kinds of things that might get at your craft are very different than the kinds of threats that we're seeing, particularly targeted to women journalists of color, and women journalists of color in particular. And so as we look to these kinds of solutions, unfortunately, our laws are not sufficient to deal with the kinds of activity and the range of activity that we're seeing online. And so unfortunately, our laws and our law enforcement is a fairly blunt weapon to try and address the problem.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco, local public radio, and on the web here at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing cyber harassment and cyberbullying with our guest Nellie Bowles, a reporter for the New York Times covering Silicon Valley and internet culture, and Professor Michelle Ferrier, founder and creator of Trollbusters.com, a website supporting women journalists, bloggers, and publishers who are targets of cyber harassment. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. Are these types of tactics acceptable when it comes to political discourse? Or is it something that needs to be controlled and policed in a different way? How do you decide for yourselves what the balance between freedom of speech and these types of behaviors, where's the balance lie? The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KALW website or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So, Nellie, I know you got to go in about 10 minutes. Can you tell us a little bit more about some experiences with doxing and neo-Nazi groups?
Personal ones? I am very, very happy to report I haven't actually been doxed.
No, I wasn't meaning you specifically. I meant in general about how this has been used to expose neo-Nazis specifically.
Oh, yeah. Well, there was a whole debate a few months ago when we saw the neo-Nazi marches in Charlottesville. There was a debate around the ethics of identifying the predominantly young men who were marching and then sort of posting their information and contacting their employers. And on the one side, people said, well, they're marching without face coverings, so it is completely fair game to identify them, you know, through the internet, post their photo and ask people to retweet it until it got to someone who knew the person. So that was one camp, and then the other camp was saying that that to get them fired and to put their name on the internet forever as a neo-Nazi is actually counterproductive and uses tactics of the internet right and that shouldn't be used. And so it was a really interesting debate a few months ago. I don't think it's really been settled. I don't think people quite know. It's complicated. Like, when is it, you know, the question, I think the headline of that story was, is it okay to dox a Nazi? And when is it okay to use viral shaming as a tool? So that was the debate that was happening.
And so, and where has it gone? You said it hasn't been settled, but what's the current discourse around this?
I mean, I think we'll have to wait and see when there's another Nazi march. It's a bit of an impossible question. I don't think there's a right or wrong answer that's easy to get to. Michelle, what do you think about it? Do you remember that whole controversy?
I'm sorry, I apologize. Were you referencing me there? Nellie.
Oh, sorry. No, no. Do you remember that whole the neo-Nazi doxing controversy of a few months ago? Like whether it was okay to name and shame them?
Right. I think it's the same thing we're seeing with the Me Too movement in terms of people not having due process, and yet we have
exactly.
the digital record and
it's
or
totally,
evidence, or we think we have that evidence
the
in order
now.
To be able
Me Too
to
You're totally
out
right.
them with their own words. So I think in terms of where we are right now, it is going to be challenging because our digital identity and that digital record is going to continue to follow us. And I think that's the ultimate message for your listeners, is that what goes online stays online in a lot of ways and in a lot of places. And
don't go on the
knowing
internet.
How to be able to navigate that kind of a culture is going to be really important in the future.
But specifically to this point of some people saying, you know, there are some people who need to be shamed online, and this is a great tool to do it. It's the right thing to do. Could you make an argument to say that neo-Nazis are fair targets here, whereas in other situations, like a female journalist of color, not? I mean, that's, I think, what I think Nellie was getting at.
I mean, that's
I
the debate.
In terms of whether there's free speech, I mean, I'm an advocate for the First Amendment, not only for the press, but also for freedom of expression. And I think it's important for people to be able to express their views. I think where we find trouble and where things cross the line is when that speech does incite people to violence, whether it's in physical space or finding somebody and being able to attack them in physical space and or have them removed from their jobs. And so I think it's really important that we understand that counter-narrative can be used in certain ways and deployed to create action, but ultimately it may be counterproductive for us to continue to use the tool to fight fire with fire and instead use other tactics to be able to go after them.
And what is on the horizon, Nellie Bowles, in terms of social media platforms, in terms of what kind of tools they're trying to develop, and where they see their responsibility in all this? I mean, there's some discussion that, of course, you know, these types of virulent speech really drives traffic. So there's a little bit of a, you know, conflict of interest in trying to manage it, right?
I think more than driving traffic per se, this sort of hate speech, I think policing it and stopping it or filtering it is just really hard and very expensive and gets you all of a sudden into moral gray areas and all sorts of debates that if you are a tech platform, you don't want to get into. And that has been the kind of company line for many years. But then I think, and maybe I'm being too optimistic about this, but it seems like in the last year there's been a real change where these platforms like Twitter, like Facebook, are starting to acknowledge their role in the content of what's on them. And they can't just say, you know, we're the canard that has been going on for years here is, oh, well, we're just the tubes. We're just the pipes. Like Twitter or Facebook is just a platform. Everything that people put on it is none of our business. And that's changing. Twitter's getting a lot more strict about content and faster at taking people offline. Even a platform like Reddit. You know, Reddit's actually been a great example where for years it allowed itself to be the meeting place for many of the internet cesspools who chatted and organized in this sort of freewheeling forum. And this year, they just decided that they weren't going to do that anymore. And so they shut down a lot of the more radical white supremacist groups and just said that's not welcome here. And what they found is the users from some of those really radical groups went and migrated into the more mainstream groups and stopped behaving so badly and started being like better internet citizens of the Reddit community, which was really interesting. So I think these platforms are starting to wake up and understand a little bit of their responsibility, mostly because of years and years of people writing about how bad it had gotten.
Besides the ethics that might be motivating, are there other motivations for why they might be going in there and trying to filter these types of conversations? Have they been, you know, threatened with loss of revenue from their, you know, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons Twitter, Salesforce didn't buy Twitter was because of, I think Michelle might be talking actually, but one of the reasons Salesforce didn't buy Twitter was because of some of the toxicity around the content on the site. And so it was kind of like, who wants to, you know, necessarily get in there? So yeah, it affects the bottom line to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. Michelle.
And specifically, yeah. I was going to mention back in, I think it was late 2016, the European Commission has been looking at this issue fairly intensely. And at that time, I believe, came out very strongly against the platforms and asked particularly that they put measures in place to solve for this. And because there was a bit of dragging of feet on the platform side, Germany was one of the first countries to slap some financial penalties on platforms that allowed this kind of speech. And so there has been some significant movement in the past year because I think of those international pressures and actions to have Twitter act as a good global citizen and fix its platform across the board. So we're seeing some differentiation of the Twitter platform based on some international pressures as well.
And I have to ask, how much of this response from the platforms themselves, from the internet companies, is because there is an outcry about how Donald Trump is using Twitter?
I think he feeds into a larger dynamic that and anybody, I think, who's been on the internet, who's been a woman, or who's been someone of color who's been on the internet since it became the World Wide Web or even before, knew this undercurrent existed. I think the past year has magnified it and made it visible to the rest of the public here and abroad to be able to see the kinds of underpinnings of what's happened here with the internet system and these global platforms that have acted with impunity because they have not had to moderate their content and, in fact, were prohibited from really moderating content in the ways that we would want them to. So I think what we're seeing in terms of this recent pressure really is forcing them. Facebook, with its changes to its news feed as a result of fake news and as a result of some of the Twitter behavior of our president, I think have driven the platforms to recognize that regardless of how neutral they might need to appear, that they can in many ways become complicit in a machinery that runs without them.
And so, Nelly, I know you need to go. Just any last thoughts or comments on where we should, as a society, take this conversation and how to approach making changes?
I think this is actually a good place for me to go on because I think that we should keep demanding that these platforms take responsibility for what's happening on them and how they're being used. The medium does, in a lot of ways, shape the message. And as you, Michelle, you were just saying, I think in the last year and going forward, we're going to see some of these flames being stoked. So it'll be more important than ever to demand that the tech companies take it seriously.
All right. Well, I want to thank you, Nelly Bowles, reporter for The New York Times, covering Silicon Valley and internet culture, previously a correspondent for Vice News and The Guardian and written for The Guardian, San Francisco Chronicle, and Recode. Just want to give you all your credits.
I've hopped around. You don't need to. Hey, thank you so much for having me on. This was an absolute pleasure.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye,
guys. Great.
Have a good night.
You, and so, So, are you still there, Michelle?
I'm still here, Joseph.
Excellent. Sorry, I heard that like big screeching noise, and I wasn't sure what just happened. So, let me just reintroduce the program, and then we're going to talk about the more personal level, what people can do to protect themselves and respond when they are victims of these tactics. So, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and we're discussing tactics such as trolling and doxing, and how they have become weapons used to shame, intimidate, and harass people online. We just heard from Nellie Bowles, reporter with the New York Times, and for the rest of the hour, we continue to speak with Michelle Ferrier. She's a associate professor at the University and the founder and creator of Trollbusters.com, website supporting women journalists, bloggers, and publishers who are targets of cyber harassment. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number to dial is 415-831-4134. You can also call us toll-free at 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. You can email or text us at cityvisions@KALW or post a comment at the KALW website or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. So, Michelle Ferrier, you had this experience in the first person in terms of you receiving hate mail and then other types of bullying and harassment. Tell us a little bit about your personal story and then where that took you.
Years ago now, and I was working as a columnist at a newspaper in Florida. And I was the first African-American columnist at that newspaper and began to receive hate mail, both electronically through email as well as through the postal system. And at that time, about 12 years ago, we were still finding our way onto social media. But my interest and my background was in online communities, and so I was working at that time in building online communities and understanding community norms and how people operated online. So we saw these very similar kinds of trolling behaviors and issues with online commenting on our news systems, etc., even in those early days. But I wrote a column and received hate mail, but particularly from one particular letter writer who wrote me consistently over a series of years, to the point where I did end up going to the police and seeking police protection in order to be able to go to work and live. And ultimately ended up leaving that job because of the hate mail and the threats against my life and my family.
Well, that's quite upsetting to even hear about. I can't even imagine what it's like to go through it. And so what did you... You didn't stop there. You didn't leave the newspaper. You decided that you needed to do something more about it.
Sure. Actually, so I did end up starting a project after that called Spot Hate that was looking at trying to map what I saw and believed was a rise in organized hate and organized crime in the U.S. You have to remember, this was just about the time that President Obama was being inaugurated for his first term. And I was writing as an African-American woman and columnist during his rise and his political rise. And I felt very keenly the kinds of threats that the president and or the president-elect at that time was receiving before he was inaugurated, because I couldn't get the attention of the FBI and the CIA to look into my particular case because they were busy sending off the threats against our first African-American president. So I was seeing a pattern of behavior manifesting in my own life that just had me terrified, and really over the years just wore down my family and myself to the point where we felt like we had to just move our family and start over someplace else. But I started a couple of years ago when Gamergate was very much prominent in my feed. I went to a hackathon and said, let's do something that's anti-Gamergate that can support women who are being targeted online. And that's how Trollbusters was born, Joseph.
So say a little bit more on how Trollbusters really tries to rebalance or drown out the hateful voices, basically using the same tactics in some ways, right, as these...
Sure.
Yeah. Say more.
So, So earlier we talked about counter-narratives or ways in which people are using the internet to get information out about neo-Nazis and who they are and identify them have some consequence to that. And there are ways that, that the internet and digital means can be used to fight back against what we see online. So when somebody comes to Trollbusters to let us know that trolling is happening in their feed, we will come into their feed and support them and let them know that someone has their back. Particularly for journalists, Joseph, the dynamics of what happens online can be very fast and furious, and things can be devolved very quickly. For example, someone can be getting, 25 to 50 tweets an hour from a person or a group of people who are targeting them, where it's just difficult for them to be able to respond, let alone even continue to do their work in the face of that kind of social media onslaught. And so what we try and do is intervene to let the target know that somebody's there and supports them, and we provide them with information about what they should be doing right now to shut down their digital footprint, their physical footprint, to be able to regain some control over the situation and to engage management and others in supporting them to stay online and doing their work. The other thing that we do is operate in their feed, providing some counter narratives and letting the trolls know that we're there watching what they're doing. We do pick up and monitor the feeds of both our targets as well as the trolls themselves. And so we're watching to see what's happening online and capturing data that can be used with management to go to law enforcement and other places as well. Hmm. So we really try and be there to support the targets no matter what kind of attack they're experiencing, to understand how they should respond, because it is very different depending on the kind of threat that they're experiencing, and to let them know where they should be pointing themselves to next, because time is of the essence when these things happen, and giving the targets a sense of agency, a sense of control over the situation is key, and getting them armed with the information and the supports that they need right away is crucial to making sure they can be successful.
So a couple of follow-up questions to that is, you said it's how to respond is different depending on the situation. I imagine if someone's life is being threatened, then there's, you try to go the law enforcement route. But what if it's someone who's giving you all of this negative feedback? Is there something to be said about just ignoring it? I mean, does the problem go away that way? I mean, is it about, just turning off the feed so that there's no attention there anymore? Or
sure.
How do people learn how to decide when to pick a fight or when to stand up for themselves, so to speak?
Know when to hold them, when to fold
yeah,
them.
Yeah, exactly.
Know when to walk away. And that really is about reading the cards and reading what's in front of you. And that's one of the tools that we try and educate people about with Trollbusters. One of the key things, we've been in operation now, it'll be 3 years this month, where we've been looking at what makes the situation, as I talked about earlier, those 4 points, this situation so different for journalists and other thought leaders who are putting themselves out in that public square. And we found that getting people the information they need right away is really key. The other thing we did, Joseph, was develop an infographic that says what to do and where to go. And that infographic breaks down from someone's insulting me online, somebody is libeling me and discrediting my identity online, all the way to those explicit threats. I'm going to come kill you tomorrow after work in the parking lot of your building, where they've got explicit instructions in there. Those with such a range of activity on the insult side of things, you may want to block if there's just one person that's continuing to target you and you don't see additional actors jumping in into the fray. On the other end of the spectrum, if you're confronted with somebody and a death threat, I'm saying seek safety now. Don't use your known pathways to travel. Secure your phone and location immediately. Contact management and contact the police. You're going to respond very differently to that kind of threat. So we really help educate people about what that next step might be, how they should respond, and be able to take some control over that situation.
And earlier you said that, you know, our legal system really can't keep up with this because it's different in certain ways and the tactics are different. Then let's say someone goes to law enforcement. What tools does law enforcement have to help protect this person?
So there's a very different situation. So think about revenge porn, which is one of the ways in which people can be abused or harassed online, is by disclosing compromising images of them online. And so in that situation, you typically know who has taken the pictures or how those pictures might have been exposed. And so there's a very different police response to that when you can point them in the direction of who the perpetrators are. When you go to the police with an online abuse or harassment case where you are unable to identify the perpetrators, they are using anonymous channels, they're engaging in using bots and the dark web and other channels, dark channels to be able to communicate, etc., you can spend a lot of time and energy trying to figure out who that person is and not really have any resolution. And the police are there to stop the criminal activity. So they will say, unless there's something that they've actually done to you in physical space, there's very little that they're willing to do. To subpoena the platforms, to get IP addresses, to do the digital forensics work to find out who this person is. There's very little knowledge they have of how to do those things, and not a lot of willingness under the law to engage in those kinds of expeditions without knowing who the person is that they're targeting. So it's a very difficult road to go down to try and go the legal route to get some redress for what's happening to you online.
And that's why some people really make big decisions to move out of town, to change their identity, their name, you know, to really go underground, because there's not a lot that law enforcement can do in certain cases.
Right. And it really is about protecting your identity. I really, you know, it's something that we don't think about very often, but I teach young journalists how to go out into the workplace, and we oftentimes encourage them to develop a portfolio of work while they're still in school, etc. We're seeing young students in our student media who are working for a college newspaper being attacked in these very same fashion. So these are concerted efforts by people who are trying to shut down voices even before they've graduated and stepped into the profession, are targeting them in our student media. And I encourage people to, especially young women, to think now about using and creating a separate professional identity so that they can preserve some of their personal life and identity in a 24/7 news cycle.
Wow. And so what do you know about how many incidents of violence against targets has actually occurred? Is there any data out there?
Oh, gosh. There's data globally on the targets of journalists who live under repressive regimes, who are either jailed, have been targeted with slap lawsuits, frivolous lawsuits to keep them in court and paying money out, or used to shut down their websites through legal lawsuits, to the murder and death of journalists in other countries, as well as an increasingly tightening regime here in the U.S. that is making it very difficult to be a journalist here in a country that has enjoyed a free press up till now. And so when you ask to quantify it, it is very dangerous times right now, both here and abroad, to be a journalist. And we're seeing the internet weaponized. We're seeing these tools weaponized in a way, not just here, but overseas, in other countries, that's having a significant effect on people's lives, people's abilities to live their lives, not only as journalists, but
the secondary targets of these activities, including the sources of journalists and others that also come under attack in these situations. So we're seeing the ripple effect that can have significant silencing and chilling effects on the journalists themselves, as well as important investigative work that they may be pursuing that ends up becoming abandoned because of this kind of activity. So it is very insidious, very dangerous, and doesn't bode well for our ability to be able to get great, good news and information, variety of different viewpoints into our news and information.
Besides the idea of using a separate professional identity, which I imagine at some point could be tracked and figured out, do you see a time, or could you imagine a time where maybe it's a collective of journalists that are reporting something under some group name as opposed to any individual's name? I'm just curious, kind of where could this go?
That is being done already, actually. And apologies, you asked me the question. I can't think of the publication off the top of my head. It's a UK publication that already uses anonymity. It's staff writers. They don't use bylines. And so no one person can be targeted for the material. And oftentimes journalists here in the U.S. are concerned about transparency and credibility and authenticity. And yet this publication has been able to maintain a very credible and very highly valued information source, even with using that kind of anonymity. So I think some of our professional norms and culture is shifting as well, as we have to adjust to these digital environments and the always on 24/7 kinds of ways in which we're being asked to do our jobs.
And what else, what other advice do you give to young journalists, established journalists, about what they can do besides arming themselves with information about how to respond or spot patterns, and then perhaps setting up this separate professional identity, which might be hard for people who are already established, right? What else can people do?
And so I do recommend splitting your social media accounts, having a professional account, having a more personal one that you use for personal relationships. We also encourage and armor you to look at and learn digital protection tools. The best protection is prevention, and we believe helping people understand the ways in which they expose themselves online, information about themselves and their location digitally, how they expose themselves through how they do their work, that we can help educate them on using two-factor authentication, using password managers, using end-to-end encryption in the work that they're doing so that they, as well as their sources, are protected. So there's a variety of techniques that people can use both personally to protect themselves by some of the techniques that I mentioned, as well as what they should be doing as part of their natural workflow as professional journalists and as communicators that in many cases must protect sources from attack, from these kinds of attacks as well.
And we have an email from Anthony who asks, what is the responsibility of the employers in these situations? So basically the employers of these journalists.
So that's very interesting that Anthony should ask that, because we haven't seen it here. But as I mentioned earlier in the hour, we're seeing some significant pressure from abroad on U.S.-based platforms, Twitter, Facebook, and others, to really clean up freedom of expression and the kinds of activity specifically that they're seeing. And so when we look, Anthony, at these platforms and the responses that are happening, employers have not yet here in the U.S. Been held liable. However, when we look at some of the new policies, social media policies coming out of the New York Times and other different types of people that are places that are requiring journalists to use their social media, use their personal social media identity, and use this online environment as part of their job, it does become a workplace environment issue. It does become a workplace harassment issue. And in fact, I believe there's a case out of Canada where a journalist did sue an employer for an online harassment hostile environment and won that case.
And so I do believe that there's huge exposure that media companies have right now for not protecting their employees who are working and using social media channels for distribution and don't have policies and procedures in place for dealing with online and offline harassment like this.
There's a lot of catching up to do, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
So
we've got some catching up to do, definitely.
Yeah. So you've talked a lot about how people can protect themselves from a prevention standpoint, and then also then how to respond if they become a target. Let's get back a little bit to the discussion we had towards the bottom of the hour with Nellie, which is, you know, the ethics of as a society. How are we going to create norms that will change this. What are your thoughts about what has to happen, if anything can happen, to really to really shift this? Or is it really people are going to be in the defensive mode here?
Well, Joseph, you're going to end on a dystopian note here, because I tend to take a very perhaps more realistic and probable view of the future, in that our digital identity will in fact become the shape, and already has in many ways shaped many of our physical actions. Think about how employers currently use our social media profiles to dig into and find out about us before you even get the interview. And so our digital identity is becoming increasingly important, and being able to secure your identity and to be able to prevent these types of intrusions, harassment, threats, etc., is going to be really important moving forward. So definitely armoring yourself, becoming more aware and understanding of how you can protect yourself online and off, whether you're a journalist or not. This is an issue that affects every single one of us who has data that is circulating online, and that's pretty much all of us at this point with the kinds of data breaches that we've had. So I think it's important for everybody to armor themselves, to learn more about this issue, and to educate themselves about tools that might be appropriate for them in order to be able to protect themselves online and off.
And do you imagine that sites will start to maybe take some of the tactics or the approaches that print journalism does, where it's sort of you print one letter at a time and maybe you select the response to the letter, and there's someone who arbitrates kind of what gets posted.
Correct.
Do you think this will become an issue for people that will decide that we're going to curtail some of that supposed excitement around freedom of expression on the online world, that we'd roll it back a little bit?
Joseph, I think we've been experimenting all over the place in whether it's creating a more curated and moderated experience. In fact, in the early days, we had much stronger moderation, and I think a much better view of how to handle the online environment. We've become more lax, and I think that also has contributed to some of the very vile discourse that we're seeing online. So from online commenting systems that newspapers are using to these social media platforms, I think it's going to take a multi-pronged approach from the platform themselves, from individuals using resources like trollbusters.com, or going and locking down their social media channels. Really, it's helping them to understand that in this digital environment, they have to be proactive in being able to secure their identity online.
And could you see a time when, maybe not in the next several years, but where regulation comes into play?
I think that's going to be a challenging one, especially when we're talking about communications and information that's traveling globally. The kinds of actors that we're seeing that are operating out physically out of other countries, this would require a coordinated international effort. And my fear would be that those same efforts and laws that might be put in place to help strengthen freedom of expression, so that we do feel free to be able to express ourselves, would also be used against us in different ways. And so I don't hold out a lot of hope that, legally we can come at this, but I think it has to be from a variety of different fronts.
Well, I want to thank you, Professor Michelle Ferrier, founder and creator of Trollbusters.com and associate professor of journalism at Ohio University Scripps College of Communication, for a very interesting primer on this topic. Thanks for joining me this evening.
Thank you so much, Joseph. I really appreciate being on the call today.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was Damian Miner. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang. I'll be back next week. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week. That's a band.